Okay, well, it's great to be here. Hopefully something in this is of interest. Okay, so I'm going to talk about gene gain and loss, but to set it up, I'm going to talk about something else first. What I'll call the King and Wilson paradox, after Mary Claire King and Alan Wilson. And what King and Wilson said in cartoon form was, how do you go from this reconstructed human-chimp ancestor 5 million years ago to modern chimps and modern humans, neither of which look like that ancestor, but we probably look a little less like that ancestor. That's Sewell Wright. What they said in words was that the genetic distance between humans and the chimpanzee is probably too small to account for their substantial organismal distances. So they had some immunoassay data and some DNA hybridization data. It all pointed to about a 1% difference at the DNA level, and they thought that that was too small to explain, essentially, the differences between human and chimp, morphologically. So there are several solutions to the paradox. The classic one, I guess you could call it, is that the coding regions change, and 1% really is enough. You know, King and Wilson don't give any reason for why 1% shouldn't be enough. Maybe that 1% is all adaptive evolution, and then that can explain the differences. It's just their intuition that it's not enough. And there are some good protein coding genes that we found to be under adaptive natural selection between humans and chimps. This is an example of ASPM. This is a human mutant for ASPM. You have a reduced head size. Normal humans look like this. It's not known that the changes in ASPM were responsible for increased cranium size, but certainly they're associated with this trait, and they evolve adaptively. That wasn't King and Wilson's favored hypothesis. Their hypothesis was that it was regulatory. Now, I'm going to say cis-regulatory. They were actually a little vague about what they meant by regulatory. But there are now two examples of genes that are evolving adaptively in humans in their upstream regulatory region. One of them is in this gene, prodynorphin. Upstream of prodynorphin, you can have 4, 3, 2, or 1 repeats of this 58 base pair sequence. The more repeats you have, the more endorphins you have. So you produce a lot of endorphins. This person doesn't produce a lot of endorphins, is more likely to have a thrill-seeking personality or to be addicted to crack. It's true. And it turns out that all of the other primates have only the one repeat, it's not a repeat, and that in the evolution of modern humans, there have been 5 nucleotide substitutions in that single 58 base pair region, and then it subsequently expanded into a multiple repeat region. And this appears to be under positive selection by lots of tests. And this is work from Matt Rockman, who was here, and me when we were in grad school. A third possible explanation is that there's been lots of gene duplication, and nobody's really proposed this specifically for humans, but Susumu Ono was certainly a big proponent of gene duplication in all of evolution, and there are some cases of genes that have been multiply duplicated in humans in the last 5 million years. One of them is DUF1220. DUF stands for Domain of Unknown Function, but they know the DUF genes are expressed in the neurons in the brain. And this is a measure of copy number, so here's humans, lots of copies, and here's all the other, many other primates. Finally, gene loss has been recently put forward as a mechanism of adaptation, and Maynard Olson called this less is more. And there are some really great examples of this in human evolution. Probably the sexiest is MYH16, which has been knocked out in humans in the last 5 million years. MYH16 controls this giant muscle that goes from your cranium to your jaw, and it makes a really strong muscle. It requires a really big attachment site on your cranium. We've lost MYH16. We don't have this big muscle. We don't need a big attachment site, and then consequently, you can get a really big cranium. It's not really known what the order of those events were. But a gene loss associated with a huge morphological change. Okay, so these are the 4 kind of vague solutions I'm going to propose. There are others. There have been some changes in splicing, and there have been some changes in RNA genes. So there are lots of different ways you can get evolution, but here are 4 really common ways. And lots of people have concentrated on these first 2, which are the coding regions under natural selection in humans and which are the regulatory regions under natural selection. But I'm going to focus on these last two, duplication and loss. So I'm going to try and accomplish two things. We want to quantify the amount of gene gain loss that has happened in humans, and I'm going to talk about across mammals. And then we might find lots of them, but we want to know whether those are under natural selection, so we're going to try and infer the action of natural selection on those gene gains and losses. So my talk is basically three parts. I'm going to tell you a little bit about statistical and computational methods we use. I'm going to talk about quantifying gene gain loss, then talk about natural selection on gene duplicates, just to preview some of the results so you can keep track of my claims and then how I get there. So I'm going to tell you that primates gain and lose genes at about twice the rate as other mammals. Between humans and chimps, at least 1,400 genes, about 6% of all genes, are not shared. So they've been duplicated in humans or duplicated in chimps or lost in humans or lost in chimps. And that the newly duplicated genes are undergoing adaptive evolution at a high rate, much higher than single copy genes. Is there a question? Yeah.
Sorry, if 6% of all genes are not shared, what does 1% difference exactly
mean? You know, that's like 40 slides from now, but I promise I'll get back to it. This is just meant to, like, you know, tease you. Okay, so let me talk about some of the methods we use to get to the 6%.
Can I?
Yeah.
So, type number three, does this refer to both copies or to one of them?
You mean the duplicates?
Adaptive evolution.
Yeah,
it's also 40 slides.
I'll tell you, that's like 60 slides from now. but it actually applies to one of them, and it's one of them in particular, which is interesting. Okay, so to study gene gain and loss, first I have to define our kind of working unit, which is gene families. So gene families are groups of genes that share sequence and presumably functional homology. Okay, so orthologs and paralogs are in gene families. Gene families arise by duplication. They grow smaller by deletion or gene loss. And basically the first thing that people notice when they sequence multiple genomes was that the size of gene families differs among species. So here are just three gene families, and here are the first five eukaryotic genomes sequenced: yeast, worm, fly, human, and Arabidopsis, mouse ear crest. And you can see that the numbers of these types of genes in each of the genomes change quite a lot. And lots of people have said, wow, look at this big number of homeodomain genes in humans. That must have some adaptive explanation. But they don't necessarily propose any big adaptive explanation for the 183 nuclear receptors in worms. But gene gain and loss in each of these lineages has caused these differences. And in some of them, whole genome duplication. So I'm going to ignore whole genome duplication and just concentrate on individual genes that are gained and lost. So we proposed a model such that you could study gene gain and loss and make some inferences. So it's going to be a homogeneous birth and death process, a well-known stochastic process. Birth is equal to duplication of a gene. Gene families can grow larger through birth. Death is going to be deletion or pseudogenization. Somehow you lose a gene that's functional. Again, in cartoon form, you have some ancestral genome, in this case, that has six genes. One derived species from it has four genes. One derived species leading from it has 10 genes. In this model, I don't care which gene is which. So all I care about is the counts. That means there could have been four losses and two gains here, but I still count only a net loss of two. And here, there could have been 10 gains and six losses, but I still only count a net gain of four. And I'll tell you about methods that we've been using so that you can keep track of each gene and get a better count of the exact number of gains and losses. But actually, it totally supports the fact that if you see six and four, you infer maybe two losses. That's probably the best recreation of history. This is just here to say that the model excludes lots of stuff about gene duplication and gene loss. It doesn't pay attention to the mechanism of duplication, whether it's tandem or retroposed or transposed to a different place. But I think it captures lots of the actual biology, and it will capture lots of what's going on in evolution. So here's the model. You can write down the transition probabilities of going from one state to another state. You need four parameters. You need the ancestral size that you started from. You need the current size, so the parent and daughter sizes. You need the time that has elapsed for a change to occur. and you need gain and loss rates. So you can get two of these parameters from a tree. So your current family sizes are the family sizes you observe in genomes that are alive today. You don't know the ancestral sizes. The times that have elapsed are defined by your phylogenetic tree. So the phylogenetic tree and the current sizes are two of our parameters, and probabilistic graphical models allow us to estimate these other two parameters, the gain and loss rates and the ancestral family sizes, that is, the sizes on the internal nodes of that tree.
Infer the gain and loss rate, then you need several families and assume some kind of homogeneity.
Yeah. We're actually going to. Yeah, we're going to estimate. You can actually do it for each family.
You would somehow only get some net difference between gain and loss. Or you need both, or you want both rates.
So I'm going to make a simplification, which is I'm only for now going to estimate one rate, which is gain and loss, and I'm going to assume they're at equilibrium. And that's partly because if you look at the genomes, they're of equal size. So they're not consistently expanding, or they're consistently all expanding in the same way, and they're not consistently shrinking. So that makes it a little easier. For an individual family, you couldn't estimate both of those separately.
But so can you say the birth-death process, is that each copy gives birth at a constant rate and dies at a constant rate, or that the total probability of a new copy showing up is fixed?
No, it's proportional to each gene. So larger families will always have more chances.
Okay.
But the rate is per gene. Yeah. So variance scales with the size of the family.
And in this model, as you said, it holds that you're not taking into account cases for which you create some genes and lose them again, but you just do.
Oh, that happens.
Right. But is it in this formula somehow? I cannot read.
Is
this a sum basically?
Yeah, that's what it's doing. So it's saying, you know, if I go from 1 to 1, I could have gone to 2 and then back, and that's what it's doing. It's summing over all those paths.
Cool.
But I'll show you that when I infer the numbers, I'm just going to take the straight count and not, you know, I'm just going to take the minimum amount of change that has happened.
Is it in the practical data analysis? How well defined is this loss and gain? I mean, the loss and gain is probably itself taking some time span. Or a protein could be degraded but not fully lost. Is that a practical issue, or is it in most cases straightforward to say lost or
It's not. This gets into genome annotation problems, which are genome annotators call genes that look like genes. And they call lots of things that look like genes but aren't genes, and they call lots of things that don't. They could have been lost and you can't tell because just the expression has been shut off. I'll tell you a little bit, but we require that you find a gene in multiple species. Actually, we require that you find it essentially across the whole phylogeny that we look at, not in every species, but in all the major groups. So we try to control for the kind of weirdnesses of genome annotation that, you know, they're liable to call thousands of genes that aren't real. But you can tell that because they don't have homologs in any other species. I mean, some genes must be like that, but not thousands. Okay. So we can use this probabilistic graphical model machinery, PGMs, to infer those two hidden parameters. We estimate the average rate across all families, so we're going to have thousands and thousands of families, about 10,000 families. And then as you're inferring the most likely value of this parameter lambda, which is your birth and death rate for every gene, you're actually also inferring the maximum likelihood value of the ancestral state at each of these nodes for each family. So for this toy example, it works out that the ancestral states are all, the most likely ancestral states are all 10. Okay, so it's just a toy. I made it up. But for every family, you're going to estimate the most likely states because that's the state fit by the most maximum likelihood value of your rate parameter. And we're going to do something very simple to infer gains and losses on each branch. We have the maximum likelihood values of these, and we're just going to say, okay, how many net changes have there been on each branch? So here we've gone from 10 in the human chimp ancestor to 12 in humans, so there's been minimum of 2 changes. There could have been more gains, and more losses, but we've only seen two. And on chimps, there's been minus two. On this branch, there's been zero. It's a really long branch, so there have probably been equal numbers of gains and losses. But again, I'll show you later, that doesn't appear to happen that often. Okay, so all of this is done by a program we wrote called Cafe. The original version has this cute little job interface. Now it doesn't anymore because we can specify a lot more parameters, but it's still pretty easy to use, hopefully. So those are the methods we're going to use to analyze gene gain loss. So now to quantify it. So here's the genome size in the well-sequenced mammalian species. These are basically the genomes I'm going to be using: human, chimp, macaque, rhesus macaque, mouse, rat, and dog. These are the total gene sizes and gene number, but some of them, again, don't meet this criteria that they have homologs in other species. So about 3,000 of the mouse genes disappear because you can't find anything that looks like them in any other genome, so we think they're just annotation overcalling of genes. So we run our machinery across 10,000 trees. I haven't put it here, but about 10,000 trees in all of these species, the 10,000 families. The families range in size from, you know, one copy in all six species to hundreds of copies in all six species. Some families are zero in one species and, you know, a dozen copies in another species. So families do change in size quite a lot across the tree.
Why would there be such a long open reading frame as opposed to genes? This business of, you know, why are there things that look like genes which aren't found somewhere?
I mean, so part of it is that you say, you know, long open reading frame. Well, there are unlikely open reading frames. I mean, you know, that they're 60 amino acids, but they're still not really long. I mean, I think clearly if it's 1,000 amino acids, it's real. But I think you can, by chance, especially in a mammalian genome, get a relatively long open reading frame just by good luck.
So can you do some statistics and say, you know, those you've thrown out 3,000? Can you say that it would be really likely to find 3,000 false positives by the methods they were using in the annotation?
You could. We've never tried that. I believe some of those are real genes, and there are cases where there's good evidence of genes that are de novo that arise in only one lineage. But I think that our requirement that you have to find a homolog in another species is at least conservative for this case. So there may have been many more gains and losses. They're just not being analyzed here, right? So it's a gain of a gene, but it's only present in mouse. Maybe mouse really has gained 3,000 genes de novo. Or all, you know, the five other species have all lost homologs of those. Is also possible. But at least we're taking a minimum count.
So does that mean you have, if you have long branches in the phylogeny, you can be missing more genes of those branches?
You mean because there's more losses?
Yeah, I don't know what the correct way to think about how this affects the methods is. Clearly, the criteria you have for throwing away
I think what happens is that on the longest branches you undercount change because you miss many gains and losses that you just see the net number at the end. So that will happen. But I'm not sure that there's any effect of genes that don't have homologs on in other species just because there's a long branch. Okay. So we estimate the average lambda, that's this gain-loss rate per gene, to be 0.0017 new gains or new losses per gene per million years across the tree. So that's the average across all of these species. Other groups have different methods for estimating just the rate of gene duplication, essentially by counting up how many young duplicates there are in a genome in the first million years, or in the last million years. So these estimates are between 0.013 and 0.026 for same mammalian species used here. So our machinery is telling us about the same thing that other methods are telling us about just the rate of gene duplication, which is what's measured by those. So it turns out, though, that now we can estimate heterogeneous rates across the tree. So we have many, many families, so we can see whether some lineages are evolving faster or slower than other lineages, and that this average rate across the tree isn't necessarily the best indication of what's going on.
So can you just say a little more about how you define a gene family? you say there's 10,000 altogether?
Yeah. So we're using in most of this, in everything I'll say today, the ensemble defined gene families. So what ensemble does is they take all the genes from all of these species and many other species, and they make a big distance matrix. They do all the protein distances, and then they try to cluster them into discrete families. And I guess I don't say it here, but what we've done is to take, and so then they get families. So that's the end result that they post on their database. And we've also taken their data and reclustered it, because you don't want any particular inference to be based on, well, I set my threshold here, like in a family you had to be 80% similar. So we vary that, make it more stringent and less stringent, and then rerun all these analyses. But I'm just going to tell you this for the standard ensemble families. Is that kind of answering your questions?
Okay, so it really is just the criterion is things tend to cluster together.
Yeah. And so one important thing is that, you know, a family can be just single orthologs in all of these species. It's just, you know, the family size is one across all. That's still a family, because we don't, and there can't be a distinction between things that are size one and things that are size two, because you're allowing them to give birth and to lose genes. So they're all called families. Although lots of people say multi-gene families to try and distinguish them from things that are just one copy. Yeah.
What ensemble do, if I understand correctly, is to build clusterization upon an instance matrix based on the sequence difference between different bodies.
Yep. Yep. No. So I think there's lots of things where there's lots of cases. You know, I think ensemble divides the olfactory receptors up into a couple of different families, and most people would all, you know, call them all olfactory receptors. But I don't think there's really a qualitative difference between what people call families or superfamilies or anything like that.
But so for your purposes, isn't the question whether or not the differences that you see within a family could have arisen due to a process other than duplication or vice versa, that right? So the model that you're using is that all of the differences are duplicates that have then had time to diverge during the tree that you're looking at?
That have diverged in terms of copy number.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, it's not looking at nucleotides. So we have looked at whether the clustering, you know, breaks up a family such that, you know, you kind of take one away from one species here and add it to another species in a different family. And we found one case of that. It accounted for one loss in one family of all of them. So I don't think, and maybe that's what you're kind of getting at, I don't think,
I mean, I guess conceptually the deal is that the ensemble is sort of heuristic, right? It just clusters them based on distance. It's not asking a question about whether or not the differences that you see over the course, the depth of this tree could be due to processes other than...
What's the other process?
Yeah, I mean, so... I guess the problem is that if you split a group of genes into two different families, you'd like to know if that those two families could have arisen by duplication and some divergence over the course of your tree or not.
Well, okay, so you could think of a case where, let's just say, you know, for however reason, you know, there's a family that is of size 2 here, and then it doesn't change at all over the tree. So now you really have two subtrees, each of which have one, you know, there's two orthologous sets. So it's possible that ensemble calls those two families, each with one in all the species, instead of one family of two in all the species. And I don't think that really changes the inference that much.
When you now talk about this local inhomogeneities of the rank, isn't...
Yes, there's a local inhomogeneity.
Well, so that this red part and so on. So is it really still sort of, can it be inferred from the data that loss and gain remains the same despite the fact that both of them vary homogeneously, or is it the input of your inference?
Because, so,
you know, as long as everything is homogeneous,
yeah, yeah.
It's a, it's a very sort of convenient simplification. But now, since it's getting dependent on the tree, would you, or would, if you were to repeat the analysis with keeping both rates open, so to say, would you?
So what you can do, and I think I'll show it to you, is that you can infer the numbers of gains and losses on each branch. And what you find is that on average, I mean, there are the same number of gains and losses across the tree, but on any particular branch, you could have more gains or more losses. And so you could say maybe there is non-homogeneity in those two rates on any particular branch. And we can test for that. I just haven't. But you can look at the numbers of gains and losses and also tell that.
And they seem to be sort of constrained.
They differ on any particular branch, but they're always approximately near each other. There's nothing that's really extreme except, and I'll talk a little bit about this, in the chimpanzee branch, there appear to be more losses, and that's because of the quality of the assembly.
But you could say sort of between us and dog, it's still consistent with being loss
yep.
and gain the same.
Okay, so there are differences in rates across the tree. The rate here in the best fit model has three parameters, one for human and chimp, one for the ancestor and macaque, and one for the rest of the tree. Importantly, if you remove the chimpanzee genome, because it is probably the lowest quality, you still get an accelerated rate along the human branch relative to macaque and the rest of the genomes. So there does appear to be this difference in the rate of total gain and loss along the tree, and that means that if you compared, say, human and chimp, you'd see more differences, more gains and losses between those two genomes than if you compare two equivalently diverged, at terms of time, rodents or canines.
And these are estimated by maximum parsimony, right?
Maximum likelihood.
No, but I mean, when you sum up over the sum, you're just taking one term in the model that you were mentioning. Is it something like that you just count?
Oh, yeah, the counting, but I'm not doing counting here. This is actually the maximum likelihood rates, not the maximum likelihood, not maximum parsimony, essentially counting.
Right, but I guess I'm asking, how sharp is this maximum likelihood?
It's pretty sharp. Yeah.
So when you assess the statistical error of the estimate, or a vague idea at least,
Yeah, so what we've done is simulate lots and lots of trees using single rates or multiple rates, and then you can, you know, ask whether a chi-square distribution for our likelihood ratio test is appropriate, or whether this difference in rates you see are real, and they do appear to be very real. And we can actually simulate them with unequal rates of gain and loss, and then see if that is responsible for what we infer here to be total differences in rates of gain and loss, and that doesn't appear to be true either. So if the total rate is the same, but it's just asymmetric between gains and losses, you still won't find this difference in rates along individual branches.
How about if you use mouse and rat as your reg? Reg color and everything else is something different. So why make humans and chimpanzees important?
I see. Well, two reasons. The first is those previous estimates had actually found that humans had a higher rate of gene duplication than mouse and rat. But actually, more simply, we can estimate the full model with 2n minus 2 parameters, and that is not as good as a model where... And then in that model, you get an estimate for every branch of the tree, although it has some trouble converging. But consistently, you get the same rank order differences in rates, and these are always the highest.
But that's not what I'm asking you, right? I'm asking you if you instead of making humans and chimps the focus of hybrid mutation rate or gene loss rate, why don't you make the mouse and the rat the focus and see if then you get...
Oh, that model is not significant. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I see. Okay. This is the most significant one.
Yes. Or rather, the mouse and rat model, you know, if there was one parameter for this and then one parameter for the rest of the tree, it might be better than just one parameter, but it's not the best fit model. Yeah. I mean, those aren't nested because I'm comparing one that has a ratio here, but if you just compare the information criterion in some way.
But you could define a sequence of nested ones, right? And follow the tree of
A-S-E. You could, but yes. But you'd still have to start out with one, you know, hypothesis.
Right, but then all the rates are the same. And then you ask if I...
Right, but what I'm saying is that, you know, if there's a model with two rates, one for the rodents and one for the rest of the tree, that's...
Better than one rate.
Yes, but it's different. It's not nested in any way with a model that looks like this.
Right, but those two are equal in AIC.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you can
that's
pair them in AIC.
Yes, but not nested. Okay, so we see this rate of difference in rate of gain and loss across the tree. Why exactly? And there are some. I don't have an answer, but I'll tell you my best guess. There is an explosion of ALU elements, a certain kind of transposable element, right here at the base of the old world monkeys. And so it's possible that this explosion of transposable elements results in an increased level of non-allelic homologous recombination. This process by which two chromosomes will pair, and that leads to duplications and losses. Okay, so lots of very similar transposable elements lead to this. That doesn't explain exactly why humans and chimps have even a greater rate. But again, the population size shrinks right at the base of the hominids. So it's possible that some combination of this increased number of highly similar transposable elements and then reducing population sizes, which some models say will increase duplication rates but don't say anything about loss rates, result in this accelerated rate in the hominids.
So these other elements, they're so sprinkled all over the genome?
Yeah. And they all appear, I mean, they're really... I think Esther mentioned this yesterday. They all appear at once. If they appeared slowly over time, that wouldn't really result in this burst of gain-loss because they have to be very similar to pair across chromosomes. But they appear everywhere. Yeah.
Well, there were a few epochs, right?
Yes. But this is the...
That was the major.
Yeah, that's the big one. Yeah. And today, I think they're all being lost. There's no active ALU elements that they've ever found. But there still is sometimes non-allelic homologous recombination among some of them.
With the exception of the mouse and rat, you know, the highest rate are between these species that are very closely related, where you have a kind of fine evolution, and then the next.
So we've also tested for whether, if you...
You see, in the long branches, there's been a lot of gains and losses.
Right. So we've tested for that effect. So what we can do is simulate data with one parameter and then see if we consistently get back higher estimates on the rate on the branches that are close together, and we don't.
The reason you might do that is because there is really more than one process going on. I mean, yeah. if you're looking at closely related species, you could have fast gain and loss of genes that don't matter very much. So the ones you gain, you lose again very quickly. Right? And you see that on the close species.
Oh, yeah.
If you look at distance species, you don't see that because you see the slow processes, which are really the gain and loss of things that are very important and that get fixed in the genome. Right? And you won't see that. I don't think what you was saying would test for that because you were not allowing there to be different time scales in the model in the first place, right?
I'm using the same tree, but I'm not saying there's two processes, so it's true.
But it could be checked, right? I mean, so the lifetimes of genes, whether they are following a Poisson process or have their peak at that. Separate peak at low.
Yeah, there is some. There's some result on how long you think genes should stick around. And it is possible that things are even fixed, but still they'll eventually be lost and you're detecting those on shorter branches and more recent branches. I'm not sure there's any way around that except to get more species.
You could look at genes that are highly expressed and see if you have more loss or gain in functional categories that are important, such as acetylated genes like this.
So why do you think that would get at this?
Because the gene loss evolutionary rate would be boiling in some parts of functional classes and not important in others. And over time, as Paul said, this would dissipate. And so if you go up the phylogenetic tree, you're seeing less in some sense. You're seeing things that have already settled down, whereas down at the bottom, you're seeing things that are still evolving.
We've looked at functional classes a bit, and I'll talk about them in a minute. I'm not sure. My intuition is that there are no families that have stopped evolving. They're all still duplicating and deleting. At least at this depth. I mean, maybe, you know, at the Cambrian explosion, there was a huge explosion, and then everyone settled down. But in the last 90 million years, I don't think that's what's going on, but that's just my intuition.
Okay, between the biggest distance that you have, like human and dog, so for a given gene, what's the probability of being lost if you integrate your rate?
But just the rate times the numbers of
many genes. Right, so that phylogenetic distance, if I get take a random human gene, what would be the probability to find it in dog?
I don't know. So, So there's a tricky.
All I'm saying is, one could look whether it seems like whether the loss is sort of a linear function of the phylogenetic distance. That would sort of address Paul's concern of whether the sort of whether loss and gain are correlated on short time distance, or whether
the problem is that his phylogeny is not close enough. I mean, he's finding a higher rate in the short branches. So you will see a non-linear effect. And the problem is that you don't have enough lineages on the tree to test whether there's a non-linear effect across the whole tree or just the whole part of the tree.
I mean, what is certainly true is that there are segregating, still polymorphic duplications and deletions. And of course, that's true of any comparison of genomes. You know, the genome is not a species. It's an individual. So even for nucleotide data, this human has some derived mutations that are not fixed. So you could try to take into account polymorphic things, but that doesn't exactly get it. Still, there might be these two processes of duplicates that are fixed that can still be lost. Losses that are fixed aren't coming back, of course. So I guess you could look at loss rates, and then if those are still heterogeneous over the tree and still higher on the most recent branches, then that can't be explained by two different processes, because those aren't going to be resurrected. There's one example of a loss that was resurrected, but I think that's pretty rare. So there's this accelerated rate. We actually do have one more genome being sequenced right now, the orangutan. It falls about here on the tree, and we've run our model again, including orangutan, to see if the speed up happens after the split with orangutan or before the split with orangutan. And the best model is, again, orangutan groups with macaque. So the speed up happens just essentially in humans and chimps and possibly gorilla. We'll have to wait for the gorilla. The orangutan genome, again, isn't the greatest assembly. We were talking about this. But it's still slower. So it says the genome assembly is not artificially making it appear to be faster.
Do you know what the effective population size is in orangutan?
It's huge. It's really big. So one of the problems with the assembly is that it's lots of heterozygosity. So it's historically much larger. I mean, right now they're on two islands, Sumatra and Borneo. But historically it's really large.
And they're post the Alu explosion.
Yep. So if you think the reduction in population sizes happened after the orang split, then it's consistent with that. Yeah.
And do you see any evidence for the Alu? The Alu hypothesis is a very specific hypothesis. And it's testable.
Yeah, so I didn't come up with that. I failed to say this. Evan Eichler came up with it. So, and that was because that they found, I mean, they went at it from a different way. They found Alu elements that were at the breakpoints of many duplications that occur between chromosomes. So that was, and the timing of those duplications coincided with the Alu explosion. So that was their evidence. And it's pretty well supported. I mean, you would find dead Alu elements at the breakpoints of non-allelic homologous recombination.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, you should.
In duplication, you should see, an obvious duplication of the intervening sequence as well.
Yep.
Presumably, you could spot some deletions in the same.
It might be harder because then, your two Alu sequences would become some mismatch.
In the species where it hasn't been lost, there'll still be the Alus on the side of the gene, which is going to be
missing. Except that they're being lost in all of these lineages because they pop out easily. But yeah, we could look at that. One thing is that even in Evan's data, only 40% of all the duplicates have Alus, recognizable Alus at the breakpoints. So maybe.
I mean, it could be that certain gene families are, presumably going to say whether certain gene families contribute more to this process.
Whether which?
Certain gene families.
Yeah.
And you could test whether there's more enrichment of Alus in those gene families.
Yeah. We're also looking at whether, so Alus, mostly explain genes that are being duplicated and deleted when there's recombination between chromosomes. But we don't know yet whether tandemly arranged families are evolving at a higher or slower rate than families on different chromosomes. But we can test for that. And that gets at a little bit more what the mechanism exactly of these is. Yeah.
So when you have these non-homologous recombination events between non-homologous snippets, how big is the chunk that's being given to the allele?
It depends on the distance between the two alleles.
Yeah, sure, but like, but, know, is it hundreds of genes or tens of genes or one gene?
All of them. But okay, it's a bit of an exponential. So mostly it's small, and lots of times it's not genes. And then there's sort of a long tail.
So your model was assuming plus minus one.
Yeah. So we've looked at, so that's a problem if one family is going from two to four in one event. So we've looked for whether, you know, one family falls inside these single duplication events. And the largest we ever find is there's one family in macaque that has three genes that appear to be duplicated, but otherwise it's never, almost never two. I mean, you get multiple genes duplicated, but they're in different families.
For a time scale, is it a reasonable scenario that you duplicate like several dozens of genes and then you just throw them out again one after the other? So they're really pretty asymmetric in that you, in the sense that you get a large increase and then you sort of stagger it away.
Yes. So I think, you know, the underlying, like the mutational process, duplication is, loss is probably actually much, much more common. That, you know, you really do lose.
Much more small scales.
Yeah. I think most gene families that I'm talking about are not arrayed all together where all of the paralogs are sitting next to each other.
Are you saying that when looking at gene families, you're lumping together things that happen at very different places?
Yeah. But it does happen that two unrelated genes are duplicated at the same time by the same event.
That doesn't protect your model because you don't care about correlation.
That's right. Okay. So those are the rates across the tree. Now we can do this simple counting that I've been talking about and just count up what's the minimum number of events that had to have occurred on each of the branches. And here are the numbers. You can see, to answer your question, they can be quite different on any particular branch for gains and losses. If you count up the differences between humans and chimps, so along the human branch in the last 5 million years, 675 genes have been gained, that is duplicated. So those are unique duplications to humans. In the chimpanzee lineage, since their last common ancestor with humans, 740 genes have been lost. So these genes are in humans, these new genes are in humans, but not chimp. These genes are now in humans, but not chimp, because they've been lost from the chimpanzee genome. And if you add those together, about 1,400 genes are not shared between humans and chimps. And of course, there's genes that are duplicated solely in chimps, so chimps have them, and genes that have been lost solely in humans, so that also chimps only have them. But all of these genes don't have an equivalent number in chimpanzees. So this is about 6% of all the genes aren't shared between humans and chimps. So all of these inferences so far have been based on this model, which assumes homogeneous birth and death, and it can vary across the tree, but it assumes a simple model of birth and death. So let's look at it. Yeah.
I mean, given that the chimp sequence isn't very good quality,
yeah.
I mean, are those losses real in chimp, or are they just putting in a subcodon in a gene which isn't really there?
So I'll talk a little bit about that. So we haven't checked subcodons, but we've checked for whether they fall in gaps, and we've done it especially well in humans. But you can reverse the calculation and ask what's duplicated in chimp. So you do find in chimp, it's possible the assembly split apart genes with high allelic diversity and have been lost in humans where there's a better assembly, and you get about the same number. So there are problems with chimp, and there are genes that are in gaps, but I don't think it's a huge problem. Okay, so here's a method that's not based on my silly probabilistic model. So what I've been describing so far, we have, and I'll come back to the 6%, but I just want to show you a different way of getting there. We have these genes in families, and we assign a number to each tip. And it's basically a genes in a bag model. That is, I don't care which genes are in that species. There's three of them, or there's one of them. I just care that the bag has grown or shrunk. So there's a different way of looking at it, gene family evolution, and in which you keep track of every gene, and that's by comparing species trees with gene trees. That is, building a gene tree from the genes in the family. So here's my species tree. I'm just going to focus on this one little part of the tree. We've got human with 3, chimp with 1, macaque with 1. In my likelihood model, you can basically tell that the most likely scenario is that there's been a gain of 2 along this branch, rather than an alternative model, which could be true, that there were 3 in the ancestor, and then 2 were lost in chimp, and 2 were lost in macaque. So my model just tells us what the most likely answer was.
Parsimony. Like,
I think parsimony and likelihood are equal in this case.
Yeah. So if this is the actual reconstruction, if we look at the gene tree, then we can ask whether it's the right reconstruction or it's independent evidence of this reconstruction. So this reconstruction of the species tree and the evolution would create a gene tree that looks like this. So now the red dots are duplication events. We have macaque and chimp again, and then 3 human paralogs, which were all most closely related to one another, because the duplication events happen only on the human lineage. Okay, so this gene tree is consistent with the gain of 2 genes on the human branch. If this is the true scenario, then the gene tree would look something like this. Now, I've drawn in the lost branches, so you wouldn't see the lost branches in your actual gene tree. But your duplication events would be at the root. You'd have something like a macaque and human gene most closely related to each other, and then another clade of human and chimp, and then another clade with just human. And there's a set of methods called gene tree species tree reconciliation that allows you to take a tree, gene tree, compare it to your known species tree, and then infer where the gains and losses happen on the species tree. So we did that for all 10,000 families. We built gene trees for all of them, and then we know the species tree for the entire mammal data set, and we counted up the numbers of gains and losses. And they're really well correlated. So this is the number of gene duplicates on each branch estimated by the gene tree method and estimated by our likelihood method. So you can see that there's this really good correlation. So one thing that says is, our method works, hopefully. The other thing it says is that, you know, there aren't lots and lots of cases where there are many gains and many losses and then we're counting some small net number, which could have happened. But in those cases, the gene tree, the line would be somewhere over here, because the gene tree method would see all of those events and our method wouldn't. But that doesn't appear to be what's happening. There's basically a one-to-one correlation between the two methods.
So to ask a question about, are Mendel's data too good? Are your data too
good?
I mean, so the likelihood model, the probabilistic model, should predict something about how often the gene tree shouldn't correspond.
Yeah. So I'm hiding a bunch because I didn't want to explain it. But I'm not going to show losses because when we originally did this, and I... So this paper explains it all. But it turns out, so when we first did this, I thought we were really wrong because there was very little correlation when I looked at the total data set. And it turns out that these tree reconciliation methods, which everyone has been using for a really long time, are totally biased and give you the wrong answer, especially about losses, all the time. So if you get your gene tree even slightly wrong, it adds duplications and adds losses. And you can show that, so you can correct for that, and that's what I'm showing here for duplications. You can't correct for it for losses. So yeah, it's not actually as pretty when you start from the beginning, but at this level it's pretty. Yeah.
So on your y-axis now, this is not just the net number of this parsimonious thing, that is the rate inferred from the maximum likelihood thing multiplied with the time.
No, this is the parsimony thing.
This is the parsimony. But your model, what you were presenting at the beginning, was assuming equal loss and gain rates.
Yeah.
Such that the parsimonious. Oh, no, sorry. You can think of it.
I mean, it's equal, but in any single family... Yeah. Okay, so this just says we think it's not the likelihood model that's giving us these results. It's the actual data.
Could I ask what a point corresponds to on that?
It's the number of duplications on a branch in the tree.
Okay. So that will correlate with branch length?
Yes. That's pretty much the determinant of where the point lies.
Yeah. So suppose that you could set the bar higher by asking how well you put in rates. You know, essentially divided by branch length for each point.
But then, of course, it's the same because for this point, I'm dividing by the same number for both methods, right?
Right, but in some way, you get a high correlation, I suspect, just because long branches have more events. All methods might think long branches have more events.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be one.
That's a good answer, Todd.
They'd be on average one in the scatter and that line, which looks like you've not lots of scatter, but if you were wanting to know the rates.
Yeah, so then we'd have to predict the rates for each branch independently, which we could do and we could compare. Yep.
I'm not sure it's really great. But.
Yeah. Okay. Another interesting feature of the data set is that there are some families that rapidly expand or rapidly shrink. I'm only going to talk about the rapidly expanding ones. That is, they have huge bursts of duplications in a short period of time. And we can attach some sort of p-value that gives you an idea of that's unusual for that family. So the most common functions that are assigned to those families that show really rapid expansions are immune defense, brain and neuronal development, especially in the primates, and intercellular transport. So those, I mean, besides the brain, genes in primates are semi-uninteresting if you're just looking at them. The interesting part is that if you look at the amino acid level and you ask, which genes evolve the fastest at the amino acid level between species? These are in these same species. These and sex-related genes are always at the top. Okay, so the same genes are evolving rapidly at the amino acid level, and they're also evolving rapidly in terms of their turnover. Lots of gains or lots of losses, which is interesting. One of these families is Centaurin gamma. It looks like this. We can assign a branch of the tree where we think this large expansion happened. This one is pretty obvious, right? Humans have 15 copies. All the other species have less.
Can it be that they are evolving so fast that you are putting them in different copies?
Yeah. So if a gene is evolving at the amino acid level so fast that we can't assign homology, it looks like it's lost.
And it's a new family in
origin. Yeah, it's by itself
lost
or something.
It's
possible. So one argument is that it actually is lost. That function is completely different if it's evolved that much. It might happen. In the Drosophila data, we think we found one case of that where, you know, we could find a gene that looked like it belonged to a family. It was off by itself in its own family, and DNDS was off the charts.
So for this is for an individual family.
Yeah.
And you say that this, since you have 10,000 families, this couldn't have happened by chance.
So I didn't show you anything about the p-values, but there is a significant excess using false discovery rate or whatever kind of multiplicity correction procedure you want. There's a significant number that are really evolving very rapidly. And we've checked them all to make sure they're not just, you know, you've gone from 6 to 15, 6 to 12 or something, by duplicating them all at once. So that's not what's causing this. We can also check the gene tree. This is the gene tree of that family. The human genes are in red. Again, you see this human-specific expansion of all of these genes. I'll show you another interesting example because we have some actual empirical data to back it up. HLA is an immunity-related set of genes. They do lots of other things. And there's this big expansion in macaque, which is interesting because macaque is a model for human immunity, but they have many, many more HLA genes than us. If you look at the gene tree of this family, macaque genes now are in blue, you see multiple lineage-specific duplications of the macaque genes. They're all most closely related to each other. So again, these are all predicted from the genome assembly and then genome annotation of genes. We have some empirical evidence, though. So Jim Sekela at the University of Colorado Health Science Center has done an array comparative genomic hybridization experiment where you take genomic DNA from a species and you hybridize it to an array with a single gene represented. So now each of these rows is a gene, and then, no, each of the columns is a different species, and each row is a bunch of probes corresponding to a gene.
You see that mechanics have more HLA types or more HLA genes?
Genes. Actual loci. So maybe this I'll show you.
Six, so like humans have six and mechanics have typically the humans have six big families of HLA types.
Yeah.
So, because
so I'm saying the individual gene number summed across all those families. So you can see here, this is DNA hybridizing from macaque hybridizing to the array. If it's red, there's more copies in the genome because you get more intensity hybridizing to array. Here's all the other primates. You can see that if you do the experiment, you again see, and Jim, they have a way of quantifying how bright is this and how many new copies does that correspond to, and our methods are highly correlated. But in this case, HLA is highly expanded in macaque. So there's empirical evidence of this as well. I'm just kind of telling you some features of the data now. Okay, so we have these gene losses that I've been talking about. And so here's an example. Everyone has two copies. It's pretty obvious that there's been one loss on the human branch. There are several possibilities for why we may have miscounted a gene as a loss. So here's one possibility, which seems unlikely, but we checked. So let's say you have two genes in humans. And there's a gene conversion event, so that is a copy conversion between two different paralogs that makes essentially the whole region exactly the same between the two genes. So assemblers sometimes have trouble assembling these as two different loci because you have a bunch of reads which are all the same sequence, and unless you have the exact reads that overlap your unique sequence, you don't know where to place them. So what will sometimes happen in the assembler is that you'll get one locus, but it will have lots of sequence traces if you actually looked at the shotgun assembly. So we looked to see whether there was an association of increased read depth at the paralogs that were left when we called a loss in a family, and there was not. So that's a long way of saying this didn't happen, but it could have happened. We've also looked more carefully at a bunch of losses, things that were called as losses from the human genome. I'll tell you some of them. So we used a chimp or a macaque gene and then looked in the human genome for this gene. About 221 of these genes we found in the human genome. They weren't annotated as a gene, but we could find them. We still didn't find 203 of them. Of these, these are probably real genes that Ensemble didn't find. So they're not included in Ensemble's gene set, and therefore we incorrectly called them losses. These 203 genes that we couldn't find a good gene model for, 12 of them fell in assembly gaps. So that is, it could have been in the genome, but it wasn't sequenced or it wasn't put into the assembly. So it turns out that something like 40% or 45% of these losses are real. And this is probably true across all of these species. Ensemble, either the annotation has missed it, or the assembly has missed it, or some combination of the two. So you're not getting all genes, and you have to check for these losses. So yeah?
But how did you find them?
You just blast against the genome, and then you get a big stretch, which is similar, and then there's a program we run, GeneWise, which says, okay, here's my gene model from chimp. I'm going to compare it to this big stretch of DNA I give it from human, and it basically says there's a perfectly good-looking gene model. It's, you know, most of the length of the gene they called in chimps, and it has an open reading frame, and we can check for EST evidence. Lots of them have EST evidence, and somehow Ensemble missed them. Even though this is essentially what Ensemble says it's doing to call genes, it misses some. Okay, so one of the things we've been working on recently is to be able to take these low coverage genomes and do something with them. So if low coverage causes there to be decreased numbers of duplications called because you can't assemble them well, separate them well, or decreased coverage causes there to be more losses, you want to be able to take that into account. And then there are some genomes which have ESTs. They're not even a genome assembly. So you'd like to be able to estimate gene family size from ESTs. And all this shows is that even if you have 100,000 ESTs, and this is from Arabidopsis, you still only get about 50% of the known genes. So there's a lot of slop. If you try to use ESTs to estimate gene family sizes, there's lots of error. If you try to use low-quality genomes, there's also lots of error, and we're trying to model that error right now. Okay, so let's go back to differences between human and chimps. There's large numbers of differences between the human and chimp genome, 6% at the gene level in terms of genes that aren't shared between the two species. And I've been calling this the genomic revolving door for a while, but only Todd has ever picked it up. So I'm just going to keep repeating the phrase in the hope that it gets more play. But, you know, I think genomes are not, you know, there's not two genomes and they have single nucleotide substitutions and maybe a little indels, and they're static. That these things are kicking out genes and accepting genes all the time, and even though human and chimp both have 22,000 genes, they're not the same 22,000 genes. They can be quite different.
It's related to this, but go back to the higher rate in human. You're actually averaging the rate of two different processes. You only have one genome to start with, and you mentioned the polymorphism issue. So there really is sort of the establishment of, you know, a copy number change, and then there's the fixation of that change. And it seems like in the more distantly related species, the estimate's mostly coming from that fixation, whereas like from the human chimp, since...
Can I show you something in two slides?
Yeah.
I think I'll address exactly this.
Okay.
Hopefully. It's one slide. So we have this human chimp divergence estimate. And of course, we have predictions for the level of polymorphism and the level of divergence between any two species. Everything's neutral. And we know these numbers quite well for nucleotide divergence. So between any two humans, we're about 0.1% different if you compare two sequences. And if you compared humans and chimps, we're about 1.23% different. And that includes, of course, the things that are polymorphic in humans. So now there's copy number variation data from humans. So that is, these gains and losses were originally variant in the population, segregated in the population, is what are now called copy number variations. So if we kind of think about the same numbers for copy number, our estimate is 6.4% difference in terms of copy number between these two species. And then a paper just came out in Nature Genetics, which has hopefully the most accurate estimate, it's actually lower than previous estimates, of polymorphism for copy number in terms of genes. So this McCarroll et al. Paper says that in terms of genes, there are between 100 and 120 genes that differ between any two humans. Depends on which human population you look at. So that's about 0.55%. And what's nice is that these two things, I mean, they should be exactly related. They should scale. It should just be the ratio of 4n to 2t. If mu is the same within single nucleotide substitutions and within copy number variants. And they are about the same ratio. Okay, so divergence and polymorphism are scaling together. Divergence is about 5 times as high in terms of copy number as single nucleotide substitutions, and polymorphism is about 5 times as high in copy number than single nucleotide substitution. So this gets me back. I guess I'm about 40 slides in because I promised I would talk about this in 40 slides. So King and Wilson said humans and chimps were 1% different at the nucleotide level. And I said the number of genic differences was much larger than this and is higher for humans than would any particular pair of, would it be for primates. So the 1% is true. I mean, they really are 1% different if you count only nucleotide substitutions between orthologous sequences. So the way that it's standard to count differences is, let's say, here's my human sequence and here's my chimp sequence. I ignore everything that's aligned with a gap. Right, so now I only compare the stuff that's in here. And that is 1% different between humans, or 1.23% different between humans and chimps. If you have the same orthologous sequence in the two species, it's 1% different. But that consideration doesn't count at all the DNA that's unique to either of the two species. And in fact, if you count up indels, it's also about 5 or 6%. So two very different ways of estimating divergence. Either one is more right than the other. They're just different ways that we've always been calculating these divergences. Okay, that's a good time for me to break. Okay, so hopefully semi-convincingly I've told you there's lots of gains and losses. And now the question is, do they matter at all? So that's part three. We're talking about natural selection. And first we're going to talk about this thing that's very popular now, which is called a genome scan for positive selection, which is essentially for any pair of species, you want to find those genes that are under positive selection, you know, the things that help you distinguish Sewell-Wright from a chimp. And so there have been a number of these studies in humans and flies and many other many things. So here are some of the results from those studies. The first one that didn't use a method that gave you 75% false positives was by Nielsen et al. In 2005. They're comparing just human and chimp. And they found at P.05, 35 genes recipient out of 13,000, about 0.2%. The method is conservative, obviously. At an FDR less than 0.05, all they can say is that there's not zero genes under positive selection. Not one, but not zero. Several other papers have come out that use macaque to polarize changes, which should give you more power. So basically two papers at the same time came out. About 150 of 13,000, 14,000 genes, that's 1%, and at an FDR of 0.05, two genes were under positive selection. So, you know, these should be a little surprising. And other tests, other studies that have done slightly different tests or have used population genetic data come up with more. So there are more candidates for positive selection at the nucleotide amino acid level.
This is on the basis of
DNDS, yep. That's all these tests are. But, you know, this says there's only two genes under positive selection between humans and chimps, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The tests are weak. I mean, there's all these caveats about the tests. But one thing to notice is that they're using very few genes. And there's a new study that just came out, I think, that maybe gets the number of genes up a little bit. Why are they using so few genes? So they're not using duplicates. They kick out anything that is not a one-to-one ortholog with high confidence. If it's duplicated in humans, so there's two in humans and one in chimp, they throw it out. It has to be one-to-one between those two species, or they don't consider it. And, I mean, there are some reasons why that's a valid way of doing it. You simplify your life and your analysis, as I'll show you, but it misses, of course, lots of stuff. So we did the really dumb thing, which was to do a genome scan for positive selection in gene duplicates. So don't ignore all the things. In fact, ask about positive selection among the duplicates. And several other groups, I'll show you, have done something similar, and we can compare our results there. So here's actually what we did. I'm just going to focus on these four species of the six I've been talking about. I'll add chimp in a little while. So we got mouse, rat, human, and macaque. This is the approximate tree. And we're going to look at positive selection only in the lineage-specific duplicates. Okay, so duplications that occurred only in human and not before the human-macaque split, only in macaque, only in rat, only in mouse. So this essentially gives us independent data sets in all of the four lineages. If it happened before the speciation event, we could be counting the same branch more than once in our tests. We know they're lineage-specific both because we have the gene trees and we can assign them that way. That can mislead you sometimes, so we also make sure the two paralogs are closer to each other at the synonymous divergence level than the speciation event, essentially. So we know the synonymous distance between this and the speciation event, and we require that all paralogs are more similar than that. And we know these cutoffs for each of them, each of the lineages. So we're going to ask in each of these. Yeah.
How can you fix this? You can fix this threshold value.
So I just say if I have two paralogs that I think are human specific, I make sure that they're not more than this ds apart. If they are, I just ignore them.
This is not paralog dependent.
You mean do some paralogs have higher synonymous rates? Yeah, I mean this is the mean, so there's variance around it. But I'm just using a cutoff. So this is the mean of that comes from orthologs, you know, the mean distance among orthologs along this branch from this point to this point, and that's what we use. So among all of these sets, and we have sets of various lineage-specific trees, expansions in each of these four lineages, we're going to ask about positive selection. We're going to use this using kind of a standard method, comparing non-synonymous to synonymous substitutions per site. In this test in PAML, comparing two models, one which has DNDS, some sites have DNDS less than 1, some equal to 1, to a model with one extra parameter that has DNDS, some sites can be DNDS greater than 1, and you can use a likelihood ratio test to compare them. And the likelihood ratio, a chi-square distribution is actually conservative, as you could see from before. So we take all of these trees and we ask, is there positive selection? Are there some sites under positive selection in these trees? And here's what we see. So for the four species, we see this is the percentage of genes with DNDS greater than 1 at p.05. Okay, so somewhere between 8 and 13.5% for each of the four species. So that's high. That's a lot higher than what I showed you for the single copy genes. So we did a bunch of checks. The first check was, you know, let's make sure we're using PAML the right way. So we took a bunch of single copy orthologs. So now orthologs between macaque and human, orthologs between mouse and rat, and ran those using the same tests to ask whether there was just something different. And there's not. So here are the orthologs in each of those lineages. So orthologs still have much lower positive selection on them than the paralogs. Paralogs are showing 2 to 3 times more positive selection. Maybe there's just something wrong with PAML, and it's a maximum likelihood method again, so we always like to check maximum likelihood methods against some other dumber parsimony method. So these are results from the Nei-Gojibori method, and again, always much higher positive selection among the duplicates, lineage-specific duplicates, than among the orthologs. Yeah?
So is there a way to distinguish positive selection from release constraint?
Yeah, so that's what that test is doing. So you should never get DNDS greater than 1 due to relaxed constraint, except due to sampling of small numbers of sites. Yeah. So that extra parameter that allows DNDS to be greater than 1 is the test. Yeah.
How did you get the error bound in the previous
problem? Across genes, across the different trees that we're testing.
So I thought you're just counting the ones having DNDS bigger than 1. Isn't?
Yes. So what am I doing? That's the
number?
Yeah, and then I'm dividing by the square root of n on the number that are significant or something. Something dumb like that.
Right.
Just one quick question, yeah, to make sure I understand. You're comparing two paralogs, DNDS between two paralogs or between the species?
In the paralogs? So I'll show you the next slide. Maybe that helps to explain it. So this doesn't explain it because, if there's a single duplication event, then our tree in our lineage-specific duplicate looks like this. It has two genes, but sometimes there's more than two, so we're always just taking the tree, which can have from 2 to probably not more than 15 genes that are lineage-specific duplicates. So this is the tree. It only has human genes or it only has macaque genes, and that's the thing we're testing for positive selection. Okay, so this slide shows that, you know, there's a bit of an unfair comparison because the orthologs, of course, you're only comparing two species, the way I've showed you it's done. And in the paralogs, you can compare more than two sequences, and so there could be a difference in power. So we took only the duplicates that were paired duplications. So there's only one duplication on each lineage, so that should have equivalent power to a comparison of orthologs. And there's still more positive selection than in the orthologs. So it's not just that we have more power because each of these trees has more genes in it, and so you see more sites.
And how many genes do you infer for missing for going over the distance between species?
Not that many.
Okay.
So the gene trees are usually correct.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess one thing that could be happening is you're throwing out things that have too high synonymous divergence.
Yeah.
So could be some right sensing the distribution.
Right.
Of DS.
We could run it with all of them. I don't think it'll change anything. I mean, so the biggest thing, and you know, I'm saying this is like controlling for power, but of course, our DS is the highest DS it could be, and most of these have lower DS. So there's actually less power in the paralogs than in the orthologs. Okay, so not a power issue. Talked about gene conversion before. Of course, if the whole gene is converted, then there's no differences and you can't see anything. But if part of the gene is converted so that this gene looks somewhat like this and somewhat like itself, there's this very strange behavior we found that PAML says there's positive selection. There is no positive selection, but with some frequency, PAML says there is. Well, I won't go into why that might be, but essentially different parts of the gene have different trees, and then that confuses PAML. So we throw out the genes with conversion just to make sure that that's not causing our results. So it turns out, to begin with, fewer than 5% of paralogs have undergone conversion. So it's not a huge problem. And even after we throw those out, it's not like we've thrown out all the ones that were undergoing positive selection. Here's just a side note about conversion. There is an interesting pattern. So this graph actually shows two things. So it's showing converted pairs of paralogs, so pairs where you detect gene conversion and pairs where you don't detect gene conversion, or the rest. So the first thing you can see is that there are many more converted pairs when the two paralogs are on the same chromosome. And in fact, it's much, much more likely when they're within 50 kb of each other than if they're on different chromosomes. But something else, which will lead into a later analysis, is that there's about equal numbers of pairs of paralogs on the same chromosome or different chromosomes. So lots of these paralogs are on different chromosomes. They're not just tandem duplicates. It's about evenly split. But there's not a lot of gene conversion anyway. So. They can, yep. So, I mean, that's essentially a form of non-allelic homologous recombination, is that two genes that are similar are pairing, even if they're on different chromosomes, and exchanging DNA.
And you're saying it's rare, it's more rare, but it's not significantly rarer than the...
It is significantly rarer. There's no error bars or anything like that. But
yeah.
Across all four species pairs, it's significantly rarer.
So
This blue bar to this blue bar.
But it's like
and the fact that there's not a different distribution of genes on the two. So.
Different amounts of divergence, because presumably to detect a gene conversion event, you have to actually have
some divergence.
To see a track of life.
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's known that there are more interchromosomal pairs on... There are more interchromosomal pairs that have lower divergence in humans. It's not true of the other three species, and this pattern holds in all four species. The same kind of thing happens. Okay, so the proteins, the paralogs, are paralogous proteins are under positive selection. I think we can exclude lots of alternative explanations for why that could be. There are other checks we've done that I'm not going to bore you with. You can ask whether the upstream region is also undergone some sort of accelerated evolution. So Katie Pollard at UCSF has taken our data and looked at the upstream region and shown that, in fact, this is just in humans. This isn't a test of DNDS because it's upstream, but the paralogs have much greater level of accelerated evolution in their 5 kb upstream from the start of translation than do single copy orthologs. Okay, so the proteins are evolving faster and under positive selection, and the upstream regions are also evolving faster.
This is just so how does that statement come about? So it's
which part?
This is rank. So the upstream region is just a number of substitutions in that interval, or
How does Katie do it? Yes, basically. She's saying that among the paralogs, the rate of substitution is higher after the duplication event than it was before the duplication event in the upstream region.
So it's not formally equivalent to DS greater than 1 result?
No, not at all. Because, there's no DN and DS.
Yeah, there's no...
Yeah, and so... I mean, there was this paper that looked at positive selection and tried to do something equivalent to DNDS upstream, and they used like the first intron. But then there was just, I don't know if you saw that, there was a letter written saying you can't use the intron because the intron's evolving more slowly. So, it's just, it's accelerated in the paralogs relative to the rest of the tree.
Can I ask just, in the duplication, is it usual, this 5 kb is usually duplicated as well?
Yeah. Good question. So no, and it's really interesting. You can look, a duplication happens and a gene is put in a new spot. So its 5 kb upstream from it, I mean, is homologous to a 5 kb that in every other species doesn't do anything. So those accelerate just as much as the 5 kb that you take with you, which is kind of interesting, right? I mean, you get put down somewhere and the stuff in front of you, obviously this is conditional on the fact that you're now a functional duplicate, stuff in front of you has accelerated. So it probably doesn't happen in every duplicate, but that is what's happening.
So this comparison is between the 5 kb at the locus, not necessarily the 5 kb before every duplicate. I'm not sure I'm saying this correctly. The alignment between the 5 kb region of one duplicate and of the other?
Well, so in the cases where it moves, you can't align it with the other, so you're aligning it with orthologous sequences.
Okay.
In the other species, yeah.
So, do these 5 kb otherwise show constraint?
The ones that weren't doing anything before? No, usually they're just random non-coding DNA. So, you're asking maybe, could they have been interrupted and then just relaxed selection on that?
Right, I mean, the question is whether there would otherwise be signature of negative selection.
Yeah.
Only in that context would sort of this acceleration be... I don't know. I'm sufficiently unclear about it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So my interpretation is if they're not under negative selection previously, they are fortuitously accumulating substitutions that are then being selected for in front of this essentially new gene with a new promoter. And there are real examples of that happening. But I don't know which proportion. I mean... This is accelerated. This is not positive selection.
Yeah.
But so I can't tell those two things apart. But we could look, I guess.
How much upstream does a gene tend to take with it when
it depends. So even when it's if it's RNA based, not much. There are now like an example where it takes some of it. If it's DNA based, it could be missing its first exon, it could have a megabase upstream. So it changes between pairs of duplicates.
Just that you might expect there to be some effect of how much it did take with it. On the, you think the more it took, the more likely it was to be functional when it arrived.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody's looked at that. Esther, has anybody, it, like the more DNA upstream you take with you, the more likely you are to be functional? I don't know that that's... it's a good hypothesis. Okay, so the upstream regions are also...
And this averages across the original gene and duplicate genes, averaging everything.
Yep. All of this still doesn't say whether, selection is causing the duplicates to fix. I mean, we don't know. It just says lots of paralogs. Or whether they originally select for, even if there wasn't selection to fix them shortly after fixation. So I have some indirect evidence on that. And that is, we can look at these families that were rapidly expanding. So there's the families that had huge bursts of duplications and see if those are associated with more positive selection, because then maybe there's a slightly stronger link between the selection and the fixation of those genes. So we have some low cutoff for saying something was rapidly expanding in all of those species. And in fact, it's true that rapidly expanding families have more positive selection than families that duplicate but aren't rapidly expanding. Yeah.
With this data, I'm thinking about one thing. You are aligning, when you do the orthologous comparison, you are aligning the same gene. When you do the paralogous, you are aligning different genes that might have different lengths.
Different
lengths?
Yeah, so of course we're only comparing the part that we can.
The part that you can align really well.
Yeah. I mean, you can't calculate DNDS if you can't align it.
Yeah, but the beginning and the end. You know, might not be exactly the same.
So I didn't talk about this. We have very strict cutoffs for what we're willing to calculate DNDS on, because you know, if you get even one codon off, then you know, PAML, any program doesn't know you've misaligned them. It just thinks, oh, there's three substitutions, right? You've gone from CCC to TTT. And that's really a lot. So we essentially throw out every codon that has more than one substitution. So that's pretty conservative. But that's essentially the cut we're making. There's also cuts on whether there are gaps around your codon. But yeah, so we're trying to avoid that.
So I guess I still don't quite understand how you're dealing with the
X constraints. So this is the PAML test. M1A.
There's going to be a mixture of genes, some of which are still constrained, some of which are not constrained.
This test is run on every tree independently.
Yeah.
So I'm just reporting the proportion of trees. Oh, you mean every gene in the same tree?
Your axis here is percent of DNDS greater than.
Yeah, percent of the families.
That's really? A test that's finding that?
Yeah. And I'll talk about specific genes in a second. So it could be still in every particular tree, one gene is under positive selection, one gene isn't. And this is kind of the average, is there positive selection in the tree? So those can still, and those are still slightly different questions.
But I mean, there could be a mixture of things under relaxed constraints and things not.
Yes. And sites under relaxed constraints and sites under strong constraints and sites. But the test, and you can run this, so we've done lots of simulations as well, even if you know you run it with DNDS equals 1, it doesn't call more than 5% under positive selection. In fact, it's like 3% for most cases, because it's a conservative test.
I guess I'm just trying to understand, because your orthologs aren't really, I mean, all of your orthologs probably evolve under constraints, and you know that most of them don't have the NDS. So you know that all of those are coming from a set of.
But I'm not comparing DNDS between paralogs and orthologs. I'm comparing how many are greater than 1 between paralogs and orthologs. I mean, I agree if you were just comparing the values, the point estimates would be different because of relaxed constraint and positive selection. But now we're just comparing test results.
Yeah. But I guess I don't know quite how much to be surprised by the fact that orthologs are all below duplicates. I mean,
I agree. It shouldn't be that surprising, but I mean, nobody's actually said it. And I'll show you what they have said before. Okay, so this slide just says the things that evolve rapidly also evolve rapidly in terms of number, evolve rapidly in terms of amino acids.
Can I ask something? So these duplication events happen at different point of time. So
yeah.
Can you estimate whether these are new events that you have with this positive selection, or whether they are all over the place?
In the gene tree?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll show you those results for one branch. But, you know, none of them are that old, right? All of this is constrained to, like, the last 17 to 24 million years. Because all of these are lineage-specific duplicates only.
That's very good about the orthologs.
The orthologs are also still only 17 or 24 million years, because they're orthologs between these two pairs. Okay. So, pretty much said this, lots of positive selection, twice as much. Graham wasn't excited. He thought that was obvious.
I guess I don't know whether that's how much relaxed constraint there is
But so how could it be relaxed constraint? I mean, you could tell me that Pamela is wrong.
No, but there's difference. I mean, no gene could be in the orthologs, could be evolving under the hypothesis of DMDS equals one, while a subset of the paralogs could be evolving under the.
But then they should still both be maximally 5% under positive selection.
No, because if the. I mean, it doesn't mean that they'll both have the same expectation.
Okay, but still the maximum should be 5%. So it could be 5% versus 2%. I mean, I'll grant you that point. But it still can't be greater than 5%.
If Hamel's right.
Yes.
And isn't getting confused by how coarse the data is. Your orthologs have forced to be deeper than the species split. And so are going to have more counts in DS,
yeah.
While the ones which you're forcing to be lower than are more discrete.
Yeah, so we've done simulations across all the levels of DS, and there's no difference in power. And in fact, the lower your DS, the more conservative PAML gets. Yeah. So it maxes out at 3% at our highest DS, but it's actually lower than that for most values of DS. Weird. Yeah.
Is it ignorant? Can you just, in one sentence, say what PAML actually does, apart from dividing the radius?
No. Sorry. I mean, I just my ignorance of what's going on inside. I know how to try and break it, and I can't break it with respect to my data set. But, I know what it's doing. It has this Goldman-Yang model of, like, each codon can evolve with a different rate ratio, and it's counting the differences. Yeah.
So it's basically accounting for the mutational target for all of these, and then kind of making a model of how whatever kind of distribution you'd get, but dividing these numbers by each other is kind of
illogical,
isn't it? If you have only a few DS counts.
Oh, that's what Nego Jabori is doing. I mean, it's like you count, you know, the number of changes, and you count the number of sites, and then you divide, and that's a bias estimate. But that's not exactly what Pamela is doing.
So
how does Pamela overcome small numbers?
I don't know. I know it doesn't behave badly, but I don't know that.
So that was the reason that I asked whether these positive selection events would be young in the applications, because then you'll have different variants for the divider just fooling yourself because you're seeing something.
Right.
Still would be just fluctuations.
Right. So all I can tell you is that when we simulate it, there's no difference. And in fact, the difference is conservative with respect to our hypothesis.
It's a number that you can evaluate from your data set.
Yeah. I can tell you the result. We have less power among young duplicates. There are fewer. If you take the shallower trees, there are fewer positively selected than the deeper trees.
But how does the real genes look? Like you said, that these genes are in positive selection. So if you look at the estimated application event, or how far that was, are they biased, or is it just all these? So are they younger on average than the set that you identified to be under positive selection?
Are which younger?
The genes that you identified to be under positive selection.
Yeah, so they're on average, the older duplicates, I mean older relative to the last 17 million years, are more likely to be under positive selection than younger. And that's because most of the young ones, we have no power whatsoever.
And so you can't label them yet.
Yeah. Okay, so we are not the first people to have looked at selection on duplicates. But nobody's actually pointed out this pattern. So here's a paper by Wen-Chun Li's group from 2003. They reported their K-to-K-S ratios. They used the Nago-Jabori method. This is figure 3A in their paper, and they actually don't ever make any mention of the fact that all of their points over here on the higher side of K to KS. They don't do a test either, so there could be some points on this side that are not really positively selected. But they don't mention any of these guys where K to KS is the same as DNDS.
Sorry.
Yeah, so I'm saying they didn't do a test, but you could. So then there's another study which is maybe more famous, and they actually did do a test. That was in Science by Mike Lynch, one of my colleagues, and Connery, and Mike kept asking me, why didn't we see it? So they do see it. So this is the human data. So the black points are significantly different than one, so they could be less or greater. So things super diagonal in this direction are greater than one, things lower or less than one. And they, if you look only at young duplicates, and they looked at huge numbers of duplicates of very, very different ages in terms of DS, there are lots of points greater than one. And there is a fleeting half sentence in their paper, like, oh, maybe there is some stuff that's accelerated. And part of the problem is that when you study genes, duplicates that are very old and very young, you're kind of integrating across very, very different processes.
What are they comparing there?
These are all paralogs in DNDS. So they have...
Paralogs.
Yeah. So, you know, things that were duplicated 100 million years ago, which are like these guys out here, they've been around for a long time, and they're probably pretty well conserved. But it's the genes that are new and the ones that have to get maintained and fixed in the population that are the younger ones. So, you know, we think that part of this is just that if you want to know about what causes there to be duplicates fixed in the population, you have to look at the youngest duplicates. After that, the signal goes away, and you can kind of tell that it goes away. So this is the place to look.
But yeah. This would be the blue parts in the histogram you showed before.
You mean old ones?
Because it's paralog. Sorry.
Yeah.
This is paralog. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah. So the argument is simply people have seen it, they just haven't noticed it. Okay, so let's go back to these results I showed you at the beginning. So these are about selection in humans, and I haven't actually been talking about selection in humans in the last 5 million years, because of course I've been talking about this branch here. So we can further restrict our study to only the human paralogs that have duplicated in the last 5 million years since the split with chimpanzee. We still have some number of families that look like that, and test for positive selection. And again, it's higher than orthologs, and it's significantly higher than orthologs. So here are the p-values. Now it's 7%. And an FDR 0.05. There's three genes. Okay, that's nice. We'd actually like to know which genes they are. So there is a slightly different test in PAML, which is called test 2, which is actually going to test for positive selection on a particular branch of the tree. So now we're going to test for selection in a particular gene and not just kind of in the tree. So for this test, we need an outgroup to polarize changes. So we're going to use the chimp single copy ortholog to polarize our human-specific trees. And again, we get some slightly higher number, significantly higher number of genes, particular genes under positive selection. It's really particular branches in humans. And again, three of them are significant. I have an FDR less than 0.05. So now we've doubled the number of genes that are under positive selection in humans.
So these two tests picked up different genes?
They do slightly different things, and we're looking at slightly...
They picked up the same genes or different genes?
Oh, the same genes. Yeah, yeah.
So three is not six.
Say that again?
Three genes, not six genes. So didn't you just say you doubled the number of genes?
Oh, yeah. I just mean three compared to two. Or it's infinitely higher. So I'll just tell you about my favorite one. Called BZRP2. So this gene has been duplicated in the last 5 million years. It's under positive selection. BZRP2 stands for benzodiazepine receptor protein. So benzos or bennies are things like Xanax and Valium. You make them endogenously. You can also take them exogenously. And this is the receptor that detects those things. So it probably has something to do with your brain. Okay, so what I kind of alluded to this a couple times. So we have these lineage-specific duplicates. So now I'm calling them H1 and H2. And then there's my chimp outgroup. And so in the tree, they're just equally distant from chimp. And technically, they're both orthologs of the chimp gene. They're paralogs of each other, and they're co-orthologs of this chimp gene. For some of them, we can say kind of which is the new one, really. So if there's a case where the chimp gene is on the X chromosome, and one of the human genes is on the X. The new one is on chromosome 16. Then we can make the inference that the one on chromosome 16 is the new one. Okay, so they're both orthologs, but it's kind of a little less ortholog than the other one. So we refer to these as primary and secondary orthologs, although that's not really important. And we have a method that will make probabilistic statements about which one is the primary, the more orthologous than the other one. And the question is, well, if you have, obviously if they're tandem, we can't tell the difference. Okay, so we essentially require that they're on different chromosomes or they're very far apart on the same chromosome in order to be able to distinguish among them. So the question is, if you had a bunch of pairs of these, which one would you think was under positive selection? So we have 28 pairs. We were pretty confident in our assignment of parent and daughter, primary and secondary ortholog. And we have evidence for positive selection, so we can compare the two. And there's the answer. So in 24 of the 28 cases, it's the one that moves, that its protein coding region is the one that's under positive selection, not the parental, not the one in the original location. So four of them, it is the one in the original location. The rest, the gene that moves, is in the one under positive selection. And this is pretty consistent with kind of the model of how genes gain new functions, that they're not really equivalent on when they're first duplicated. Even if they take lots of upstream regions, they're in a new chromosome, they're in a new chromatin environment, they're in all sorts of, there could be new enhancers or insulators that are nearby. So I think this is consistent with the fact that these new genes are duplicating, the ones that move to new places are picking up new functions. Okay, so conclusions. At least the second part. Okay, I understand why technically lots of people only study orthologs, but there's lots that you miss when you only study orthologs, because there is a lot more positive selection going on among the things that are lineage-specific duplicates. You can't test for selection on lineage-specific losses in this way, but there are other ways to do it using population genetics. So this is King and Wilson's paper. It was evolution at two levels in humans and chimps, and the two levels were protein and regulatory. So now my argument is it's much more than two levels. There's protein, there's regulatory, if you have that gene in both species. And then there's not having that gene, either because it was duplicated or lost in one of the other species. So there's actually many, many levels at which this evolution happens. And with that, I want to thank Jeff, who is a former postdoc and did lots of the work, and Mira, who's a current grad student, other grad students and postdocs in the lab, money, and I'll take more questions if you have them. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a really important result that people have to think about and incorporate into these evolution. In some ways, it's, sort of the second part is quite predictable. If you go all the way back to the earliest stuff that shows that theoretical studies, Bruce Walsh, that if a duplicated gene doesn't, functionalize quickly or attain, just the mutational pressure for premature stop codons, and neglecting even deletions and things like that, frameshift, is very, very rapid. And those things have, and of course you've thrown all those out, the pseudogenes. You're looking at the ones that have survived, and more or less that theory tells you those things be acquiring. Not necessarily novel function, but they have to.
They have to be doing something different.
Some identity. There must be positive selection. So it's good to see.
I completely agree, but the field has swung towards this set of neutral models that say, well, there doesn't have to be any selection. There can be this degradation of function in both, so you need both. So, partly I'm having fun with my colleague, who is the one who's put that forward. But I think, sure, if you went back that long, it must have been true. But if you read the literature now, everyone says, no, it's this other thing. So That's just the sociology of science, but it's funny.